welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 331, Integrating Life with Dan Kittredge, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Wednesday, October 10th, 2012. In this installment of the podcast, I'm going to play a conversation that I recorded with Dan Kittredge, who will be the speaker at an event that I will be moderating this Friday night at the Horticultural Society of New York. This event is the first in a series of talks called the Full Circle Series, moving from the head to the heart and the hands, intimate conversations with innovative, critical thinkers addressing the present challenges of our social, environmental, and economic landscapes. The series theme is bringing into being the world we want to live in now, with a focus on localized efforts. The speakers range from small local farmers and food activists to journalists and radical educators. And the first speaker in the series is the guest on today's Sea Realm podcast. It is soil expert and organic farmer Dan Kittredge. And I'll say more about Dan in just a minute, but before I do that, I want to thank the very generous souls who clicked on that PayPal donate button and sent some funds my way to help offset the cost of bringing you the Sea Realm podcast. And this week I have to thank Kathleen W., Mark C., Float23, and George D., some longtime supporters and friends of the Sea Realm in that list. Thanks again to Kathleen, Mark, Float23, and George. Also, Olga and I just got back from a trip to Vermont, where we stayed with Douglas A. You can find Douglas on the Friends of the Sea Realm group on Facebook, and you can also find him hard at work doing web development tasks in his home, where he keeps backyard chickens and is doing a lot of really sensible preparation for times to come. And Douglas provided us with hospitality, a very nice place to stay, great company, and also his mom Bonnie lives in town with him, and Bonnie did the typesetting for my book, Conversations on Collapse, so it was really good to connect with them again. We also drove to the farm of Brian S., and Brian S. loaded us down with kale, tomatoes, squash, cayenne peppers, and herbs, and more importantly, I think he gave us a living demonstration of a person who is doing the right thing, following his heart, making adaptive responses to the current situation, and doing really well at it. So congratulations to Brian S. And also Garrison B., who, crazily enough, I met in the Amazon in 2008. He also lives up in that area of Vermont, and he also is making choices that make sense regardless of whether we've got a business-as-usual future or a collapse or something in between. Garrison and his wife Allison are longtime friends of the lovely Olga K., whose voice you will not hear in this episode of the Sea Realm podcast, but she will be on the Sea Realm Vault podcast this Saturday. So about today's guest, Dan Kittredge. Dan, an inquisitive second-generation organic farmer, advocates moving beyond organic. He has put together and is producing a system for bionutrient-rich crop production, often abbreviated as nutrient-dense farming. Dan started his experimenting with nutrient-dense principles on Many Hands Organic Farm in Bayer, Massachusetts, where he grew up. He was spurred to explore the nutrient-dense paradigm after reflecting on the problem of mediocre yields and predictable insect and disease outbreaks on small organic farms. The Bionutrient Food Association, bionutrient.org, started as a project of the Real Food Campaign, whose mission is to empower and educate farmers towards the production of quality food. BFA now has its own nonprofit status and advocates for vital soils and nourishing food nationally. Today, Dan farms his own 15-acre homestead where he raises grass-fed beef, goat, sheep, and a full spectrum of vegetables. Practicing what he preaches, he finds it very easy to make good money growing nutrient-dense food. So, here's my conversation with Dan Kittredge.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
You are listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and I'm joined by Dan Kittredge. Dan, welcome to the Sea Realm Podcast.
Thank you.
I'm looking at your bio right now. It says you're the executive director of the Bionutrient Food Association and Real Food Campaign. Would you say something about Bionutrient Food Association and the Real Food Campaign?
Sure. Our basic mission and objective is to increase quality in the food supply. So we understand that there are significant diminishments that have occurred in nutrient levels in food at least over the last 70 or 80 years, as according to the USDA, and we're working to build nutrient levels back into food by training farmers, giving them the tools necessary to do a better job growing biologically, making consumers aware of the disparities in nutrient levels and the correlations with flavor, with aroma, with tendency to rot, and then also working on developing a handheld near-infrared spectrometer that a consumer can use to assess quality before purchase. And our effective strategy is to use enlightened self-interest to educate people about the disparities that exist in the food supply, and then apply leverage to incentivize people to do a better job in growing and find better quality when purchasing.
If somebody thinks that having a spectrometer in their kitchen might be going overboard, could they just default to buying organic and rest assured that their organic food is going to be more nutrient dense than conventionally produced food?
I would suggest that the most appropriate place for the spectrometer would be at the farmer's market or the grocery store. When you're actually purchasing, you can actually, just envision a little pointer. You flash the light, it's a little laser beam. It flashes onto the carrot. The light bounces back. It reads it and says, boop, boop, crap, boop, boop, crap, boop, boop, decent. And you can choose the decent bunch of carrots. So that would be where it would be most appropriately used. As someone who has, been an organic farmer all my life, effectively since the age of 4, I can honestly say that a lot of organic produce nutritionally is equal to or inferior to conventional produce. So while there are certainly, very important benefits to not having toxic chemicals in your food, assuming that organic means better nutrient levels is incorrect.
Would you say something about the difference between certifying that something was grown via a particular process and certifying that it is of a certain quality?
As far as I'm concerned, what's important in food is how good it is. And just because you don't use certain materials, there's very little correlation necessarily between what you didn't do and what you receive at the end. That wasn't very elegantly stated. But functionally, if you're referring to organic certification, one of the major components of organic certification is simply that you did not use any synthesized materials. That does not necessarily correlate with the levels of vigor and vitality in the biological system, which correlate with nutrients and aromas and flavors in the crops.
There is somebody that I've interviewed for this podcast. His name's Colin Tudge, and he's got a great presentation that you can listen to online, and it's delivered to the British Soil Society. There is a society in Britain which is dedicated to the health and the integrity of the soil. And I know that you can grow something organically, meaning you're not putting in anything synthetic, but if the quality of your soil, if your soil is depleted or if it's just not the right kind of soil, you're not going to get nutrient-dense food as a result. And I was hoping you'd say something about taking care of soil.
Yeah, well, that's, primarily the work of the BFA and the Real Food Campaign before it has been educating farmers about the principles of biological systems. And then once those basic principles are conveyed, helping them to identify limiting factors. So effectively, you need a broad spectrum levels and ratios of various minerals in your soil. You need multiple species of bacteria and fungi in your soil. You need air, you need water, you need humus. These are all critical components for a healthily functioning system. And different farms have different limiting factors. One farm may have very good organic matter, but no trace elements. One farm may have a lot of minerals, but no oxygen because the soil is too compacted. And in any one of these factors, when it's limiting, short circuits the potential of the plant to manifest its potential. So it is extremely important that growers understand what are the aspects that are inhibiting their potential of their crops and address them systemically. There's a lot of well-meaning growers are doing a pretty crappy job due to, you know, technical ignorance.
Is there any source of information that you think is leading people astray, that they're probably making bad decisions based on information from that source?
it's a leading question. I think
all of these have been leading questions.
I think that the conventional agronomic paradigm is flawed on a number of its basic assumptions, and so that would probably be the biggest issue I would point to. Conventional agronomy, what you would learn if you go to Cornell or UMass or, you know, any of the land grant universities, does not integrate life into the analysis. So it's a chemistry and physics analysis, and biology is minimally involved. We don't conventionally in agronomy understand the role of bacteria and fungi as symbiotes in the plant life process. As we understand that we have, you know, bacteria in our gut, and without them functioning well, we can't be healthy. That's that same principle is in effect with plants. Instead of having an internal digestive tract, they have an external digestive tract. So all the bacteria and fungi that are symbiotically established in the root zone and on the leaf surface are effectively the gut of the plant. And only when they're functioning well will the plant grow well. And that is a central point that I think the conventional analysis it just misses.
Well, I'd like to just get into some more specifics about the sort of limitations of, as you say, conventional agronomy and the principles that somebody would learn if they were studying, say, agriculture in an academic environment, and maybe compare that to some things which I think a lot of organic farmers who are of a sort of scientific mindset would dismiss as woo-woo, things like biodynamics or the work of Elaine Ingram and the soil food web.
Well, I don't think Elaine Ingram is very woo-woo these days. I mean, she was a professor at a university for a number of decades and is now the head of the Rodale Institute. And her work in microbiology has been very important in bringing legitimacy to the biological system. The biodynamic community is, you know, certainly more on the woo-woo fringe. I guess the point for me that's central is that it's the results that speak. And just because someone does not understand the principles of biodynamics does not mean they should throw out the results of, you know, biodynamic operations that produce high quality food. And as with all sort of components of this, of the alternative ag space, there are very good biodynamic growers and very poor biodynamic growers, and there are very good organic growers and very poor organic growers, et cetera, local, conventional, that point follows. So, I think that the biodynamic practitioners that are good have some very important insights to share with growers in general, and a real open-minded, empirically based grower should look to all of these streams of thought for insight and guidance and how to do a better job.
You're going to be giving a talk at the Horticultural Society of New York this coming Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And your topic there, as I understand it, does relate to the soil and nutrient density. And I was just hoping to get maybe a little preview of what you'll be talking about this Friday.
Well, I generally, when I give intro lectures, try to run people through a basic analysis of the biological system and how it works. I think that the mineralogy and biology and air and water and carbon, they're very intuitive. They're very practical, and for many people who are growers, large or small, to have things presented in that concept is in many cases revelatory. I'm intending to discuss in some detail the degradation of nutrient levels in food that has occurred in this country since the USDA has started measuring in the 30s, and draw some correlations to degenerative disease, chronic disease, DNA, epigenetics. There's some really good science that brings together facts and figures and presents a picture where it seems obvious to me, at least, that the quality of our food, as it's decreasing, is correlating to the quality of our health decreasing. And the basic proposal that if we eat higher quality food, we can expect greater levels of vigor and vitality is the central point I'm hoping to make.
Farmers are going to have a certain set of priorities and a knowledge base and a way of interacting with food that is probably going to be different from consumers, even consumers who are well-informed. And you're hoping to use enlightened self-interest to apply market pressure to get basically produce a demand for genuinely nutrient-dense food. I wonder what sorts of resources or information resources can you steer consumers to make them just better able to apply the principles of enlightened self-interest and make appropriate changes in the demands that they place in the market?
Shy of some well-designed and implemented research, the nose and the tongue are great sensory guideposts. If you pick up a tomato and you smell almost nothing from it, you could expect that the flavor would be minimal and that the nutrient value would be minimal. That applies to peaches and carrots and, you know, most of our fresh fruits and vegetables. So I don't think we should overlook the simple inbuilt technology we've got, we arrive with. And I think that's probably the most practical thing that people can do now. We are, you know, on the cutting edge of this conversation. Food has been primarily measured in units of volume, pounds and bushels, and by aesthetics, but not by nutrient levels. And it's difficult right now for a consumer to actually make those purchasing decisions based on empirical quality metrics. The only technology we have that is readily available and inexpensive is a refractometer, which requires crushing and getting a sample from any crop before you're able to get a reading. And that's not going to go over well in grocery stores and at farmers market stands, I don't think. So really it comes down to the, you know, your nose and your tongue. And usually it's your nose before you're purchasing. But we don't have enough data to really guide consumers well at this point.
I've heard and read that the primary things that large commercial growers, conventional growers are breeding for are shelf life and appearance. Is that right?
Shelf life. It's generally packing and shipability. The logistics of the industrial food system require large amounts of travel. Basically, you know, things being shipped and boxed and oftentimes picked before ripe. So it's the packability, shipability. And generally, they're also looking for a uniformity of size and shape and uniformity of picking time. So not having crops that come in over a 3-month window, but having crops that all come in, you know, all at once so you can pick them mechanically, et cetera.
And what about appearance?
Sure. But there's some basic nutritional components that'll help with appearance. Oftentimes the appearance comes more from the fact that there's significant levels of pesticides and fungicides applied, which kill off anything that might mar the aesthetic.
I'm very fortunate in that my girlfriend is a longtime member of the Park Slope Food Co-op, and so she's been buying locally produced food and I would hope nutrient dense food, although listening to you, I think there's probably no reason to assume that. But it's also very pretty food. I often will take a picture of things that she has created just because it's so beautiful, you know, just sliced pieces of tomato and green leafy vegetables and, you know, slices of cheese on a plate. It's just beautiful to look at. And my nose, I'm afraid, doesn't work reliably or all that well. And I'm wondering if maybe I need to sort of recalibrate my own inbuilt technology for assessing the quality of food and maybe take something away from the visual aesthetic and add some sort of nuanced sensibility, if not to my nose, then to my tongue.
Yeah, I think anyone who's been to a wine tasting or understands the principles of, the after notes and the, the whatever it is, this one has an earthy, apricot flavor, and this one is reminiscent of blueberries and raspberries. That whole concept that involves tasting of wine and correlating quality of wine, that subtlety is what we need to be paying attention to. It's really quite evident if you were to take two carrots and to just taste one, taste a slice from one carrot and taste a slice from a different carrot. Oftentimes you can get, very nicely formed, certified organic carrots that have a almost bitter flavor. And sometimes they'll be exquisitely sweet and flavorful. And the nutrient disparities between those two carrots are profound, even though they both appear, physiologically similar and, have the organic label on them or whatever it is you're looking for. So, yeah, it's really that level of discernment, attention to detail, that we can rapidly build in our own sensibilities that should be guiding us, shy of any kind of empirical metrics.
I remember years ago Michael Pollan saying that he thought that organic certification was not so important and that he would choose conventionally produced but local produce over organic that was shipped in from far away. And even if organic is not a guarantor of nutrient density, do you think that the benefits of organic agriculture still outweigh the harms of conventional agriculture and that people should choose organic just as a basic principle or a basic guidepost?
I think that removing toxic synthetic materials from the growing process is an extremely important piece of the puzzle. And for that purpose, generally saying that organic is to be preferred is appropriate. There are many cases where you have farmers that are not certifiably organic, who are doing a very good job with fertility and nutrition and are growing superior quality produce. So it's really quite difficult to say this, not that, local, conventional over non-local organic. I don't think you can, across the board make that statement if your focus is nutrition. I'm really trying to raise the topic of nutrient levels and quality as a central principle in the food movement. And I think that a lot of the local growers have a lot to learn about how to do a better job. A lot of the organic growers have a lot to learn about how to do a better job. So across the board, we can all learn to do better. And whether a grower is certifiably organic or not, in many cases, as I said before, conventional growers are doing a good job. So I only recommend certified organic practices when I give courses to farmers. I only recommend materials and products and practices that are certifiably organic, because I don't think that's a really high bar to reach. And the guarantee that we don't have those synthetic toxic materials is very important. And most importantly, to get high quality food, you must have a highly functioning biological system. And the direct effect of a lot of toxic materials is to kill off or significantly impair the vitality of that biological system. So from a technical standpoint, if you are focusing on quality, and making your decisions based on quality, that you're going to have some direct correlation there to what has happened as part of the process.
Thank you. stolen legacy of black knight to live on. Even if I pass on, my words will live on. Got a legendary mind, got a legendary soul. Footprints made of gold, my words just a stone. I'm royalty, just like a rich intelligence. Gotta watch the moves I make in my environment, cause they crafty. Every day the devil try to get you, so you gotta be swift, or you will become a victim. Change for your better word, vouchers and belts in the end. The weight don't add up on the scale. When the lights start to flash and you really ain't prepared, don't be scared, fumble up and you act unaware. Hold them bricks, play the cards that you dealt, for the books start to fall and they fall off the shelf. One by one, start looking for help, and you're staring in the mirror just looking at yourself.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast. Turn on, tune in, and take heart.
You are listening to the Sea Realm podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and I'm talking with Dan Kitteridge. Dan, you'll be giving a talk at the Horticultural Society of New York this Friday, and that is organized by Philip Butwanek. And he sent along a couple of questions that he thought I should ask. These are questions that have come to him from, I think, people that he's spoken to trying to promote the event. Philip writes, "If I may be so bold, I just got off the phone with someone who said she heard from some people they were skeptical about Dan and the process because it needs inputs, which they have to get from Dan. So that he is earning money from this venture bothers them. As if we are not supposed to earn any living doing this work. And as if there aren't other ways of getting the minerals that people who have taken the class attempt to join together and purchase in bulk." So there's a couple different issues embedded in that question. One is, do you basically present a class or a system of principles which is designed to get people to buy soil inputs from you?
Not at all. I have, effectively, I wear a few different hats. As a farmer who's been working to build the soil that I'm growing my crops in, I have found it extremely difficult to source a lot of the critical materials that I understand that I need. For instance, people who are nutritionists or nutritionally aware may be aware of cobalt as a critical mineral. Cobalt is the center of the compound cyanocobalamin, which is, commonly known as vitamin B12. Vegetarians and vegans, historically have had difficulties, getting sufficient B12 in their food, because it bioaccumulates and it's in higher levels in animal products. B12 is not only critical for our bodies, it's also critical for about 80% of the species of soil bacteria that can exist in the soil. So, it's one small example of a critical mineral that's necessary if you, want to build a highly functioning biological system, and it's extremely difficult to access because conventional agronomy does not, because it does not give sufficient weight to the life in the soil, does not make recommendations that materials like cobalt be used in fertility recommendations. Not just cobalt, manganese and boron and copper and zinc and, a lot of different minerals are relatively unavailable for growers that want to do a better job. And so for my own purposes and just, friends that I was working with, I began bringing in, 50-pound bags of copper sulfate or 1-ton pallets of green sand or gypsum. And I do run a business out of the basement of my barn supplying minerals to farmers. When I give courses under the rubric of the Bionutrient Food Association or the Real Food Campaign, I make absolutely zero mention of the fact that I have a company. If people find the company and call me up, I will sell things to them, but I make no mention of it during my courses. On principle, I would suggest that, amending denuded soil is crucial, to revitalize it. And, if you want to, source things locally and freely, we can effectively procure everything we need from seawater and various forms of rock dust. So there's absolutely no need to buy anything from me or to buy anything from anyone if a farmer doesn't want to. I do have a company that has brought together a bunch of hard to access minerals for growers that want them. But I'm very, very sensitive about this topic, and I do not bring it up when I give courses.
I think that most of the people listening to this podcast are probably fairly skilled at spotting an infomercial or any sort of presentation where basic facts are given up front, but it's all leading up to a sales pitch, and nothing that you've said gives me that feeling at all. But this brings us to the second part of the question. It seems odd that people would be suspicious that the person who is giving them information actually makes a living in this field, as if, you know, they should be cold calling to sell insurance or, you know, debt collecting or running a cash register someplace 40 hours a week and then presenting information about agriculture and the life of the soil on the weekends.
Yeah. I don't disagree.
Well, that is pretty much all of the questions that I had, except maybe there are different ways of measuring nutrient density and the nutrient qualities of food. The one that I'm familiar with is called BRIC, but you mentioned a couple others in a conference call that I listened to that you were on. So would you say something about that?
About BRICS specifically?
And alternative means of establishing the nutrient density or the nutrient content of food.
Okay, well, BRICS is certainly the most well-established and the most readily available and most inexpensive empirical technique we have available to us currently. And BRICS was a Austrian chemist, and he, in the early 1800s, won the prize put out by the German vintners to answer the question, how is it that we can predict which grape juice will make high-quality wine and which grape juice will make vinegar? They had logistical issues with, you know, numbers of barrels and amount of storage space in the catacombs underground, you know, where they put their barrels for 20 years before they decanted them. And they wanted to know which grape juice would make high quality wine and which grape juice would not. And BRICS figured out that it was the specific gravity of the juice that correlated to the quality of the wine. So in the more watery the juice, the less, the lower the quality of the wine would be, and the more dense, and heavy the juice was, the better the quality of wine is. So, effectively a hydrometer could be used to do that. That technology has been applied in the creation of a refractometer, which effectively, you can take a drop of liquid and put it on a slide and look at, you know, basically look through the end of a sort of an eyepiece and the amount that the light bends when it passes over the slide is graphically shown on a scale 1 to 32 or 0 to 32. So a BRICS refractometer is the best technology we've got, and that just gives you a simple number. A 4 BRICS is better than a 2 BRICS. And there's charts and graphs for what is excellent in carrots, which is different than excellent in cucumbers. Again, I would go back to the flavor and the aroma are the inbuilt capacities we have for discerning quality, and we're working on the near infrared spectrometry as a very solid empirical technology that can be user friendly and inexpensive for the general consuming public. Beyond that, I'm not sure what techniques you're referring to.
Is there any technique for establishing a quantifiable measurement for the, say, the mineral content of food?
There's lots of lab analysis that we can do. And organizationally, we're involved in a lot of that, trying to correlate various wet chemistry assays, mineral assays, with the presence of higher order compounds, carotenoids and phenolics and lycopene and things like that. But none of those are the kind of technique, at least that I'm aware of, that a consumer could use at the grocery store or at the farmer's market before purchasing?
There's a sort of celebrity mycologist, Paul Stamets, and he runs a company called Fungi Perfecti, and he sells additives that you can put in your soil which encourage mycological growth and just a mycelial network to form inside the soil. I was wondering if you could say something about the interaction, the sort of symbiotic interaction between various soil microorganisms and fungi and plants, and how that impacts nutrition.
Fungal inoculants, which, you know, Paul Stamets sells, are very, very wise investments for growers. The bacterial, I think that the bacterial and the fungal kingdoms are extremely important when it comes to the functionality of the plant. And inoculants are oftentimes extremely inexpensive and have a really profound effect on the plant's growth. We are perhaps comfortable with the concept of colostrum, and when the baby is born, it needs to drink the colostrum first to set the digestive tract so that it can actually digest the mother's milk. We need to establish that functioning digestive system for our physiological functions to occur well. And in the soil, it's the bacteria and the fungi that are symbiotically established with the plant root that do that. So from birth or germination, you want to establish that relationship. And in reality, if you look with a microscope at a healthy plant root, you can see the fungal hyphae, which are the growth of the fungal body, and you can see the plant root, but there is actually, no formal barrier where fungi ends and where plant begins. A healthy leaf will have, layers of fungal cells inside the leaf growing there continuously. The plant is feeding them, and they are protecting the plant. And that relationship moves to the bacterial kingdom as well. So a healthily functioning plant effectively, when it goes through photosynthesis and makes sugar, exudes out as much as 60 or 70% of the sugar it makes through photosynthesis out through the leaves and out through the roots to feed the bacteria and fungi that are its gut. And with those sugars, they send, little biochemical signature compounds, amino acids, et cetera, that say, here's your food for the day. I'd like some phosphorus, please. And so the mycorrhizal fungi goes out and, goes out, accesses phosphorus, complexes it, and feeds it back up to the plant. So there's a real beautiful symbiosis here where the plant feeds the soil life and the soil life feeds the plant. And that's absolutely crucial if you want to have healthy crops, because it's a very intelligent system, and the plant's able to readily access everything it needs to build those higher order compounds that correlate with flavor. If you want to have a garlic that has a strong flavor, or basil that has a strong flavor, or carrots or tomatoes that have a strong flavor, you must have significant numbers of trace elements, copper and zinc and manganese and boron and cobalt and molybdenum and selenium and yttrium and chromium and, iodine and numerous minerals that are the core of enzymes that are crucial for the construction of the phytonutrients, the antioxidants, the phenolics, the carotenoids, all those compounds that give us, the health-giving attributes of food are at their basis, and their cores have these minerals and trace elements that are rare. And the best way, the most efficient way, the most practical way for the plant to get what it needs when it needs them is to have that intelligent soil life system functioning.
This has been a fairly specific discussion, although your last answer brings up for me something which is very sort of broadly focused, and that is the notion of nature being red in tooth and claw, meaning that everything competes against everything else. This has sort of been a paradigm for a few hundred years now, that competition is what drives evolution, and that everything is competing with everything else. And what you're describing is something which is profoundly cooperative. And it seems to be a specific example of something which is it is ubiquitous in the natural world, and yet it is something which in our culture we are encouraged not to see. We are encouraged to value competition and to downplay the ubiquitous cooperation in nature. I wonder if you had just anything more broadly based to say on that topic.
Yeah, well, I think that's, I mean, when I refer to the biological paradigm, that's at the core of what I'm trying to convey, that nature works in this beautiful symbiotic fashion. And if we have, you know, a little bit of humility and openness, it's not that difficult to perceive it. I think that the sort of the dominant Western paradigm of, you know, the reductionist analysis that doesn't put all the pieces together to see the big picture is inherently flawed and is at the root what's causing a number of our, you know, environmental, cultural malaises, political, you know, you can go on and on. I would suggest that the reason we're having difficulties with childhood obesity and diabetes and ADHD has a lot to do with the functionality of the biochemistry in the human organism, that we've done you know, many experiments with lab rats and pigs and chickens monitoring their functionality and growth based on the nutrients that are available to them, and there's some amazing correlations when you look at a full nutrient spectrum and the growth and the functionality of the organism. So from my perspective, the life system is beautiful, it's profound, it's well designed, whether you have, you know, believe there's a conscious creator or it's evolution, I don't think is necessarily relevant. What's important is that if you can work collaboratively with the natural order of things, things do better. From a very practical standpoint, for growers, for farmers, the healthier the plant, the greater the yield. If you look at tomatoes as an example, when you see examples of tomato plants that grow 300 or 400 pounds of fruit per plant, you have to acknowledge the fact that that is what's possible. And then when you look at what's the average yield in this country on tomato plants, which is somewhere between 6 and 8 pounds, you can see, you know, functionally what the level of vigor and vitality is. So I would suggest, you know, if we want to systemically address a lot of our health issues, if we want to systemically address our emotional and psychological and spiritual issues, dissonance, if we want to address our carbon in the atmosphere issues, we want to look at groundwater pollution, at, you know, toxic chemicals in the environment and their effect on cancer, et cetera, et cetera. We can systemically address a lot of these things by working more coherently with the natural process. So, you know, I spent enough time in the East to be able to at least see outside of the box of the Western paradigm, and that perhaps helps me in my work. You know, I think cultures over time through history on all the different continents have come up with a fairly coherent analysis that really recognizes order and symbiosis and collaboration in life. And from that perspective, our Western culture is an aberration. And just because that's what most of us are exposed to, doesn't mean that that's a cultural truth or broadly true.
Well, Dan, your sort of cryptic and non-specific mention of your time in the East really sparks my curiosity, but we don't have time for me to pursue it in this conversation. But I will be in attendance at your presentation at the Horticultural Society of New York this coming Friday, and I will ask you about it then. So thank you very much for participating here on the SeaRealm podcast.
Thank you very much.
On the SeaRealm podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, never go back, never to go its back, old never go dimensions. Back.
That was Dan Kitteridge, and Dan will be speaking at the Horticultural Society of New York this Friday. It's from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. I will be the moderator. I'll also be recording the event, so it will be available for folks to hear sometime in the future, but I can't make any promises just as to how or when that will come to happen. So I would suggest, particularly if you're in New York City, that you just attend in person. I will have a link to the details about that event in the show notes for this episode, which you can find at crealm.com. That is the letter C as in consciousness, and then a dash, and then realm.com. I do hope to see some friends of the Sea Realm at that event, and then immediately after the event at the Hort, Olga and I will be rushing down to the Rubin Museum. The Friday night reception for the Horizons Perspectives on Psychedelics conference has been moved. I had announced last week that it would be at Judson Memorial Church, and that is in fact not the case. This year's Friday evening gathering will be held at the Rubin Museum of Art's K2 Lounge from 6 p.m. till 10 p.m. That's at 150 West 17th Street in Chelsea. Folks who show up early enough can enjoy a full menu of Pan-Asian dining options and beer and wine and spirits with two-for-one drinks until 7 p.m. The galleries will be open, so you are welcome to explore the finest collection of Tibetan, Nepalese, and Indian painting and sculpture that the West has to offer. Not only that, but rub elbows with the psychedelic luminaries, or at least the psychedelic researchers, who will be present at the Horizons Conference. Speakers at this year's conference include Matthew Baggett, Alexander Belser, Amy Emerson, Kevin Feeney, Charles S. Grobe, Roman Hannes, James Kent, and Ralph Metzner. Horizons is an annual forum for learning about psychedelics in New York City. Its goal is to open a fresh dialogue on their role in medicine, culture, history, spirituality, and creativity. This year, 2012, is its sixth year. During the 1960s, psychedelics entered worldwide popular culture. Fueled by the wild social dogmas of the era, recreational use became commonplace. Questions about their safety and value were answered with myths and confusion spread by both their users, proponents, the media, and the government. In recent years, a small group of dedicated researchers and scholars have orchestrated a renaissance in psychedelic research and thought. Horizons brings together the brightest minds and the boldest voices of this movement to share their research, insights, and dreams for the future. Olga and I attended last year, and we got to meet up with some friends of the Sea Realm, which was really exciting. Occupy Wall Street broke out at just about the same time, and so we gave the conference less attention than we should have, and less attention than we intend to this year. So I hope to see Friends of the Sea Realm both at the Full Circle series with Dan Kitteridge on Friday night, and then at the Rubin Museum of Art for that Friday night reception for the Horizons Conference. Meow. Mocha, is there anything that you'd like to say to the Sea Realm listenership? That's right. Yes, Mocha is reminding us that this Sunday night is the season 3 premiere of The Walking Dead on AMC. And while I'm certainly not paid to pimp The Walking Dead for AMC, Olga and Marty and I, the trio who bring you the very occasional Z Realm podcast, or Z stands for zombie, will be getting together weekly to produce new episodes of The Z Realm for every week that AMC puts out a new episode of The Walking Dead. So I know a lot of you zombie aficionados out there have been missing the Z Realm podcast, and it will return very shortly. Also, I'm hoping to record a lot of material with the conference goers this weekend at the Horizons Conference, and a lot of that material will show up on the Psychonautica podcast. Psychonautica is a monthly podcast that Olga and I do for the dopefiend.co.uk podcast network, and you can find a link to Psychonautica on crealm.com. That's right, Mocha. There is also the Sea Realm Vault podcast, which comes out every weekend, not always on the same day. This week I'm shooting for Saturday. The Sea Realm Vault podcast carries forward the themes that you hear on the Sea Realm podcast, but also explores into some territory which I'm not really comfortable airing here on the publicly accessible Sea Realm podcast every Wednesday. Vault membership is $8 a month, and I extend my sincere gratitude to everybody who has signed up thus far. This weekend's show will be episode number 10. Finally, the music that you heard in the musical interlude on this week's show is from Inspired Flight. I learned about Inspired Flight from Black Beauty of the Dope Fiend Network back in 2010. She had the band on her show, BB's Bungalow, And she sent an introduction on my behalf to them. And they sent me their whole album, and I played almost all of it in 2010. But I think the song on today's show, which is called Before I'm Done, is one that I missed back in 2010. Again, and as always, there will be a link in the show notes for this episode to the webpage for the musical guest, who is this week Inspired Flight. Well, that is all for this installment of the Sea Realm podcast. My guest on next week's episode will be Andrew Faust. I put up a lecture on the RSS feed that Andrew gave a couple weeks back that has been downloaded a couple thousand times now. It's been very popular. So tune in for a lot of the same material, but in a more conversational format, and a format that goes places that Dan wouldn't think to take a live audience at a speaking engagement. Olga and I had a lot of fun recording that conversation, and I think you'll have a lot of fun listening to it. So do join us for that, and until that time, stay well.